to get things going this afternoon. I'd like to open the Senate Committee on General Government and open a hearing on Senate Bill 556. I suppose I should say that we're a subcommittee until I can get another member down here, but that's not going to stop us, is it, Senator George? We're going to move ahead anyway. I've done my best to inoculate myself against this first bill. It's the one on veterinary duty kind of stuff. But I guess we got to just let this hearing go to the dogs right away, right? That may get rid of a few people in the audience if I keep this up, right? Let's see. I have a sign-up list, and I've got a couple folks who are actually going to try to speak for Senator Schrader, and that's pretty darn near impossible. From the Oregon Veterinary Medical Association, Thomas M. Keck. And is there a Kolb as well? Okay, come on up, gentlemen. I'll let you go first. And then as soon as Senator Morissette gets here, he gets to follow you, unless we've got a situation where Lorraine Still is taking the place of Senator Morissette, and I don't get any senators in here on this bill. I don't care. Go ahead. I'm sorry. There's a lot of distraction right now.
Senator Shields, my name is Tom Keck. I'm a veterinarian at the Dallas Animal Clinic in Dallas, Oregon, and I'm also the immediate past president of the Oregon Veterinary Medical Association, and I make no guarantees that I can ever fill the shoes of Dr. Kurt Schrader, and speaking for him, I think, would be virtually impossible. But we do share a common view when it comes to Senate Bill 556. We've submitted written testimony, and I will just go through it very quickly. I'm a practicing veterinarian in Dallas, and Senate Bill 556 concerns us a lot. As well-intentioned as it might be, this legislation would place veterinarians in the uncomfortable and unenviable position of breaching patient confidentiality. A core principle of veterinary medical ethics is the inherent trust between a veterinarian and his or her client. This privilege is the foundation of our doctor-client-patient relationships, and we take it very seriously. Under the proposed legislation, however, veterinarians would be required to violate this code of ethics. We cannot support this. We are concerned about the negative impact this might have on the established client-patient relationship. For some clients, any violation of this trust may prove to be a disincentive to have their animals inoculated with a rabies vaccine. My comment is anecdotal, noted from conversations that I've had with many veterinarians who have said they have clients who will not vaccinate their animals against rabies if private, confidential information is provided to a city or county agency for the purpose of it being cross-checked to find out who or who has not licensed their animals. If one client per practicing veterinarian in Oregon decided on this course of action, we would have 1,000 fewer animals protected around the state from rabies. This would run counter to our goal, and I imagine to the wishes of any animal control agency, or a city, or a county, or the state, or public health authorities, objective of increasing the numbers of animals vaccinated against the disease of rabies. We're not the only ones either who share this concern. I believe that the committee has received a letter from Patty Strand, the director of the National Animal Interest Alliance, who opposes the bill for many of the same reasons we object to it. It is important to know with respect to rabies and public health channels already exist in Oregon to address a situation where a potentially rabid animal has bitten a person. Under this well-established protocol, veterinarians coordinate with efforts with county health departments, local law enforcement agencies, and the public health veterinarian to corroborate the rabies vaccination status of any animal. We are unaware of any instance where this information, when needed, has not been readily retrievable as well as reliable and accurate. We believe that licensing of animals and funding of animal control agencies is the primary reason for this legislation. why we philosophically disagree, and strongly so, with Senate Bill 556 for some of the above reasons. Veterinarians are not at odds with animal control agencies. Quite the contrary. When concerns about a possible outbreak of rabies have surfaced, veterinarians have stepped forward and conducted vaccination clinics for the public at cost. We practitioners continue to work closely with animal control and provide necessary veterinary service to animals in their custody and who are in need, again, often at a cost or a reduced fee. Most recently, in Lane County, for example, veterinarians assisted animal control by re-microchipping dogs at no expense to the public. Veterinarians across Oregon also encourage their clients to have their pets licensed and routinely have available information on licensure in their practices. We do this voluntarily and have been doing it for decades, although we are not mandated to do so. Again, we believe this legislation would have the effect of putting veterinarians in the untenable position of breaking the hard-earned trust with their clients. We are strongly opposed to this and ask that you also not support Senate Bill 556. I thank you for your time and consideration, and I am open to any questions from the committee.
Do you have a brief follow-up to this testimony?
My name is Glenn Cole. I'm Executive Director with the Oregon Veterinary Medical Association. I think I'd like to maybe make a couple other points, too, is relative to public health. It's my understanding, and read about this morning, actually, in the Oregonian, where since 1990, 646 dogs have been tested for rabies, and only one has been proven to be positive. That was a case of a dog that came in from Mexico. And this is out of a number of a total of $700,000 dogs in the state of Oregon, roughly. So it's pretty clear from our perspective that there is almost a zero incidence of rabies in the state. But when there is, the veterinarians have always stepped forward to participate in checking that.
Are there any questions? I'm going to ask you gentlemen to step back. I've got a couple people from Lane County here. David Calderwood, Lorraine Still, are they in the room? Come on up.
Senator Morris is here.
Senator Morris is on the next bill. I'm looking for Senator Morris, who isn't here yet. Excuse me? That's right. Come on up. I had two senators on the first bill, only one of whom, neither of whom shown yet, and two senators on the second bill. How do I pick among senators here? Okay, go ahead.
My name is David Calderwood. I'm from Eugene, Oregon, 28104 Spencer Creek Road. I'm a retired professional dog handler. My whole life has been spent dealing with dogs and dog people. I now judge dogs for the American Kennel Club. I also belong to several kennel clubs that are responsible for bringing in many thousands of tourism dollars into this state. I'm opposed to Senate Bill 556. I feel it's an extreme approach to a simple problem and is a very intrusive bill. The problem is a low rate of dog license compliance throughout the state. Animal control needs funding in these lean times. I understand that, but Big Brother is not the way to go. There are many agencies and private businesses that can help to increase the rate of license compliance. I can help. The kennel clubs can help through the handling, obedience, and socialization classes we hold. The vets can help the same way through education and clinics, as you've already heard. We live in a rural state with the exception of the urban population up and down the I-5 corridor. Once the people in the state learn that they're going to be going into a government database, they're not going to put up with it. Either they will lie about their name when they get their rabies shots, or they may not get the rabies shots at all. If it's the latter, there will be rabies cases reported in dogs in Oregon. Please consider the first child that dies because of this bill. Thank you for allowing me to speak.
Thank you very much for your testimony. I've got a lot of the anecdotal information. I just would like a brief summary of your testimony, please.
To be useful, legislation must be effective, enforceable.
Oh, could you give us your name for the record?
Oh, my name's Lorraine Still.
Okay, thank you.
And I'm from Creswell, Oregon.
Okay.
To be useful, legislation must be effective, enforceable, reasonably fair, and safe. Senate Bill 556 fails all of these tests. The express goal of this bill is to raid pet license compliance by helping animal control agencies identify pet-owning citizens in their communities. This goal is to be achieved by turning veterinarians into enforcement tools by requiring them to report the names of animal owners who inoculate their dogs against rabies so animal control agency can track down those owners who do not inoculate their dogs, who do not license their dogs. Not only does this Orwellian method undermine the trust necessary in the doctor-client relationship, but reinforces the lingering public perception of animal control officers as dog catchers. Hardly a scenario to inspire the cooperation of the dog-owning public to either license or vaccinate their pets. If the bill passes and dog owners elect to go to out-of-state vets to get their rabies vaccinations or use false names and addresses, as has happened in other states such as California, the license compliance level and revenue will go down, not up. A much more serious result may be that some owners simply quit vaccinating their dogs against rabies altogether. According to information I received from the Office of State Veterinary Association, there has not been a confirmed case of rabies in dogs in Oregon since before 1978, over 27 years. The passage of Senate Bill 556 could change this. Rabies is not unknown in Oregon's wildlife, such as raccoons, skunks, and bats, which have increasingly taken up residence in urban settings where dogs may become in contact with them. Vaccination of pet animals that have regular contact with humans provides a barrier to protect humans from infection with rabies. A single incident involving a case of rabies in a domestic animal, such as a dog, can result in a large expenditure in dollars and public health efforts to ensure that human disease does not occur. Realistically, passing the dog vaccination reporting plan, Senate Bill 556, simply is not worth the risk.
Thank you very much. Is there any questions? Yes. Senator Verger.
Yes. I guess my question is, doesn't the state of Oregon mandate that the animals be vaccinated for rabies?
Yes, it does.
So if it mandates that my dog, I don't have a dog, but if I had one, would be vaccinated for rabies, what would be the problem of compliance? In other words, I say my dog's been vaccinated, and that's it. Otherwise, how do they enforce it?
May I answer that?
Sure.
The two gentlemen that just spoke told you how that's enforced. It isn't that we object to officials knowing that our dogs are vaccinated, such as the health department. That information then is kept in case there is an incident where they need the information, which, as the two gentlemen explained, can be retrieved. This is thinly disguised as an effort for animal control agencies to get revenue. It has been sold to Lane County and to the city of Eugene that it will bring in lots of money. Unfortunately, it won't, because as we pointed out, first of all, people do not want their name in a database where the animal control officers can look and say, oh, Mrs. So-and-so has vaccinated eight dogs or four dogs, but we have her down as only having two dogs. So they're right away there in violation of possible zoning laws and things like that. The public is tired of Big Brother. We're practically strip searched at airports. We have our phone calls monitored. We have surveillance cameras every place. Do we need to have the privacy of our veterinary client relationship breached?
Okay. So this is a bigger picture for you.
Oh, definitely. Definitely.
Okay.
This is not about rabies reporting, or us objecting to dogs getting rabies shots. That's the right thing to do, to have your dog shot for rabies.
Yes.
This is about being in a government database that's going to be cross-referenced with other parts of government, which also can be shared with zoning. Now, we've been told that won't happen. We're not sure to believe who to believe.
Okay, I better understand your position. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. I'm going to let you guys slip back. Scott Bartlett is here somewhere. Come on up, Scott. Senator Morissette apparently can't make the hearing. If I'd known that, I'd have had this bill second and gotten the other two senators that are sitting here waiting out of the room. But such is life. Do you want to explain what this bill is all about for us real quick from your perspective, sir?
Certainly. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. And to my left is Don Bischoff, the legislative assistant for Senator Morrissey,
right.
as you know. I want to thank you very much for holding this hearing, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. And I know there are certain people that are not positive on this, but I would like to tell you why it's a good idea. Every day, in thousands of communities across this country, thousands of veterinarians vaccinating thousands of dogs routinely, as they have for decades, prepare a triplicate form of a rabies vaccination certificate for forwarding to a county health authority or county animal control. It happens from New Hampshire to Florida to Nevada, across this country, without any documented incident of noncompliance or diminished rabies vaccination. We never were able to find it. I was a chairman of a task force in Lane County appointed by the Lane County Board of Commissioners. We worked for a year and a half. This is our report. And we labored on questions of how can we lower euthanasia in Oregon and in Lane County particularly. In the last decade, Lane County has euthanized more than 30,000 animals, we believe, dogs and cats. There are a lot of reasons for that. But what we found in our examination of this problem, among one of the major variables, is that only 17% of dogs in Lane County, and I'm sure it's relatively comparable in the other 35 counties, are licensed. 83% of dogs are not licensed. And even though Oregon law, as Senator Verger correctly points out, mandates that all of us who have dogs license and vaccinate that dog after 6 months, even though more than 4 out of every 5 dogs are not licensed. And yet we have animal care and control authorities that are responsible for a whole array of public health and public safety issues, not the least of which is investigating animal abuse, animal torture, which is totally correlated. We have FBI statistics point out in their serial killing profile, animal abuse is one of the key components. And I can provide enormous amount of data as to the connection between domestic violence, child abuse, and animal abuse. Lane County only has one officer for the unincorporated part of Lane County, the size of the state of Connecticut. So one of the testifiers earlier said that this was a revenue measure. In some part it is. Of course it is. And in view of the fact that this is happening across the country, let's look at New Hampshire. Mr. Chairman, in 1993, New Hampshire had an out-of-control euthanasia and shelter impound rate. They passed a law in the state legislature to, number one, require veterinarians, like they were doing in New Jersey very successfully, to routinely report these vaccination certificates to county clerks. And then they had a $2 surcharge from licenses put into a low-income companion animal spay and neuter voucher fund. In 6 years after passing that, euthanasia and impounds, according to Peter Marsh from Concord, New Hampshire, who spearheaded this law through the New Hampshire legislature, were reduced by 75%. 75%. License compliance, of course, will go up. If we have 83% of people not licensed, and obviously if you understand who they are, you can communicate with them and say, this is your civic obligation, and Oregon law requires you to comply. 95% of dog owners, at least, as far as we can tell, have 2 dogs or less. And when we talked to veterinarians, and by the way, you have testimony from Dr. Roberta Lee Boyden, who was on our task force, who strongly endorses this and points out that when she's practiced in 6 states, when she practiced in the state of Maine, there was a full-blown rabies epidemic, cross-species, including companion animals. She strongly backs this, and she points out that veterinarians apparently right now are required to report when they test horses or cows for, it is already required that we report testing of cattle for brucellosis, tuberculosis, and horses for equine infectious anemia. There is no, as far as I'm aware, statutory prophylactic or safeguard for disclosing a dog's vaccination status, Mr. Chairman. Our kids, when they enroll in school, have to have their vaccination status revealed in order to enroll in school. If it's okay for our precious kids, is it not okay for our dogs? This is not an invasion of some sacred doctor-patient-client confidentiality like psychiatric records or obstetric records or HIV testing. That is simply, you know, far-fetched. And I guess what we're saying is that Lane County, as you probably know, grappled with our recommendations and in December passed strongly, overwhelmingly, an ordinance requiring veterinarians reporting of this vaccination data. Eugene, about 3 weeks ago, unanimously passed this week. I can give you a copy of this. I have several copies of this, but they passed it. The problem is when Lane County considered our recommendation to get Lane County, and by inference Oregon, kicking and screaming into the 20th century insofar as a standard legislative fiat or protocol, the county council said, well, because there's an enforcement provision in this, i.e. if a veterinarian doesn't comply, there might be a fine. That is of the nature of a police power, and therefore every little townie and municipality in Lane County or in Oregon would have to pass its own separate ordinance. But one of the problems we were finding is there's no uniform database. So if someone lives in Lane County and their child or they or loved one are bitten, there's an 83% chance that on the instant retrievable database, they're not going to know if the dog that bit them, especially if it's after hours or on a weekend or a holiday, has a rabies shot. All right? So there are, from the public policy database, instant retrieval post-dog bite function, as well as for revenue. And the other thing we know is that when dogs are lost and stray, if they're not licensed, all too often they wind up in the Lane County shelter. Because they have so few kennels there, they euthanize dogs as other dogs are being driven in. And they're euthanized for space routinely. And then what happens is owners finally figure out, oh, God, we have our dog there. Well, dogs have been euthanized, and they haven't been returned home. If they were licensed, they would be. So there's a variety of public policy purposes, not the least of which is that we could save thousands of lives. And we're all aware that almost 40,000 dogs in Oregon, dogs and cats in Oregon, every year at least, are euthanized.
Quick question. Yeah. In other states, when you have this kind of protocol, licensure goes up, right?
Absolutely.
How many states do this, and how many don't?
We don't know that exactly. We can provide as much as we have, and we in our report, which I've given to Senator Walker, and it's online. We have about I think 6 or 7 examples. We have the statutes. Florida, the proposal that Senator Marcet gave to Legislative Council was patterned after Florida. Legislative Council kind of refined it in a way that I think perhaps could be revised, in that Florida specifies a very specific list of public agencies that can get it. This one just says any individual, only on an individual basis, can have access to this information.
Okay. Mr. Bischoff, I'd like to see you get a little more data for this committee, the states that are doing it, the states that aren't doing it, whether in factors, verifiable data that would indicate whether compliance goes up or doesn't go up, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Are there questions of the committee? Yes, Senator Berger.
Yes, one thing you didn't comment on, if I'm bitten by a dog and I don't know whether it's been vaccinated or not, isn't it true that I would have to go through a series of painful inoculations?
It's absolutely true. I understand that the inoculations now are not in the stomach. I asked Dr. Boyden this yesterday, but she said the side effects are painful. They're very expensive, and they're completely needless. If we had a database that reflected dramatically more the status of the vaccination status, you would know in a matter of 5 minutes when you contacted the county sheriffs, for example. They could tap into the database and they say, John Doe's dog Spot, yes, he was vaccinated last year by the Sunnyside Veterinary Clinic. Right now, you can't get that information, and the answer to your question is, it is true. You'd have to get this expensive and painful series of inoculations.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
In being sensitive to the opponents of the bill, however, the main thing is that it be listed somewhere. So it seems that the opposition is to the database itself. Is there a way that can be accommodated so that people don't feel that their privacy has been invaded, but if I'm bitten, I still have a list somewhere that tells me that the dog?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Berger, there is a way. You could specify that it go only to public health authority. Obviously, and we're not being in any way duplicitous about it, the secondary benefit of this whole thing is to build up licenses, to use that resources, those resources to subsidize low-income spay and neuter, to subsidize animal abuse investigations, to do the functions. I'm on the Lane County Budget Committee, and animal control, one commissioner wanted to eliminate it. It's being cut back every year. They can hardly do their functions. So I would say, yes, you can. And also I want to point out in this bill, veterinarians came before us and they said, listen, I said, really, why are you opposed to this? This is done across the country. And veterinary medical associations, like in Florida, I called them up and they said, well, we had the bill modified to have an exemption from their open records law. It's not a problem now. And I said, why are you opposed to it? And some of the veterinarians said, because some of our clients have more than the allowable dogs in the city limits in terms of limit laws. Some of them are breeders who are breeding illegally in city limits. And candidly, we don't want to be in a law enforcement mode. And that's really, if you strip through it, that's the truth of the matter, is discomfort with law violation.
I think that I'm going to allow us to gather a little bit more information on our own as we wish, and I want Mr. Bischoff to get me some more information as well. Okay? With that, I don't have anybody else signed up. I'm going to adjourn the hearing on Senate Bill 556 and open a hearing on Senate Bill 471.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And I have the two illustrious Senators Morris and Johnson to come up and speak on the bill. You'll have to do so without benefit of Judith introducing the bill, but I'm sure you're very capable of doing that. You can tell us from the get-go just what you two are up to.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Colleagues, for the record, Frank Morris, State Senator from District 8. And joining me?
For the record, Betsy Johnson, State Senator, District 16.
Thank you.
I'll give you just a brief summary of the bill, then maybe a discussion about why the bill, and then how we have proposed a conceptual amendment, which...
Excuse me, no sidebar conversations in here. You can go out in the hall if you wish. Go ahead, Senator Morris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then a conceptual amendment that I've asked the recorder to pass out that we'll be addressing as well. What this bill does is a requirement that when agencies bring their budgets forward to the Joint Legislative Committee on Ways and Means, that they include in that budget process a focus on continuous improvement and identifying the opportunities for improvement in agency processes and identifying activities that reduce costs, improve the quality of the agency's services, shorten the time for accomplishing the agency's mission, or otherwise improve the way the agency carries out its mission. Now, as a part of this process, there would be a requirement when it's justified, certainly, to do the business analysis. And in the private sector, we would call that a return on investment, where you actually put together a pro forma. You have a certain investment, you have savings that accrue out of that, and you make a decision based on the wisdom of the investment or the change or the improvement. And then also, it would require, in some cases, there may be consulting, outside services that would be required to facilitate the changes. And that would be required to be included as well. And then there would be required, once these processes are set in motion, closing the loop back to the Joint Legislative Audits Committee during the interim, at least once during the interim. And then to eventually close the loop would be when they come back before us again in the next session, that they would have a report and, in fact, identify the results of their continuous improvement efforts. Now, the question of why this bill, because it seems like it's rather obvious. And both Senator Johnson and I come from the Ways and Means perspective. Last session, and as we all know, it was a very difficult session, and as this one continues to be in terms of appropriations, I asked the question of one of the presenters of the agencies. I said, can you identify those areas within your agency where there are opportunities for improvement? And the response that I got was hopefully not, the kind of response that, you know, all agencies would give. But the response was, I cannot share that. I'm obligated to present the governor's budget, and I can't deviate from that. Which creates a climate that's very interesting in the Ways and Means process, where we as members sit at the dais as you, the agency comes before us, and we're confronted with really very little information. Now, we can dig a lot, but it still is very little information to try to identify those areas where we think improvements exist. And I can tell you, colleagues, that is an almost nearly impossible task. What we need to do is to change the culture, and that's what this bill really attempts to do, is to institutionalize the concept of agencies bringing forward to us and having identified those things that they can do differently, more efficiently, with less cost, higher quality, and bring those forward to us so that we create an atmosphere of how do we help you when we're seated behind the dais. Rather than us trying to figure it out, require the agencies to come forward with, these are the things we can do differently. And
please turn off all cell phones in the room.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. These are the things that we can bring forward. And so the intent of the bill is to institutionalize a process that focuses on continuous improvement and identifies those opportunities and make them a part of the budget process, which and I would like to make the comment, I do not want in any way to denigrate the very, very fine people that we have in our agencies. We have wonderful people. We have people that have a desire and a passion to do things differently, but it's not uniform. And what this would do is it would raise the standard, I believe, and expectations that we would have in the assembly here, that when budgets are brought forward, that they have really thought through how they can improve. And it's not just the standard to bring forward the status quo, but how do we change and how do we improve? So that's the focus of the bill. I would ask my good colleague from SCAPOOS to address a concept that she and I have been sharing and modifying in our Ways and Means. I'm fortunate enough to serve with Senator Johnson on the General Government Ways and Means Committee, and would like for her to address what we think would be a helpful amendment if it met the pleasure of the committee.
Thank you very much again. For the record, Betsy Johnson, State Senator. What we are attempting to do with the amendment that you have in front of you is to provide agencies with another tool, and we believe a very obvious tool, to help in this continuous improvement program. Oregon has had a long history of citizen boards and commissions where ordinary Oregonians come forward to provide advice to state agencies. There are approximately 200 of them. Some are advisory, some are policy, but it became clear in the Ways and Means process that the committees were not being used in a universal way and we're not engaged in a universal way to aid the management direction of their agencies. In some cases, advisory boards and commissions were used to a high degree and a great deal of engagement. In other instances, they weren't used at all. And so what we want to do is to amend this bill to really institutionalize and raise the level of expectation of board participation and oversight through this higher level of engagement. You have the language, I believe, in front of you that would set a uniform standard of governance oversight, and it lists, and I won't take the committee's time by reading it, but it would list those requirements of boards and commissions to exercise what we think is minimal fiduciary responsibilities in giving guidance to their agencies. We would also ask, and you can see this at the end of the amendment, that a governance letter signed by the members of the board would be submitted to the co-chairs of Ways and Means that certified that the Board or Commission has fulfilled the responsibilities of both reviewing the agency's fiscal status, its management, and had participated to an appropriate degree in the oversight of any legislative presentation or package that would come forward for review during a regular session. Again, I think that many of the boards and commissions are very high performing, but what we're hoping to do with this amendment to the bill, and frankly Senator Morris and I, joined by Senator Verger, are already doing it in one of our budgets that we passed out today, is to try to put these best business practices in place as part of the Ways and Means process to specifically seek the input of these very conscientious volunteers who have come to serve Oregon's agencies. We think that this will lend an air of gravitas to the service on the board and will ultimately result in better agency oversight. So we commend the amendments to your consideration. They're in the process of being drafted right now. We wanted to bring the concept forward to you and share with you our interest in seeing these best business practices be appended onto all of the budgets that are being reviewed in this session's Ways and Means activities.
I honestly can't see why anybody wouldn't love this bill. It brings greater efficiency forward. I'm serious. I mean, what's the problem? You've got amendments. You need to go forth and draft, right? And Senator Starr has a question.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And I agree with the chair on this bill. The question on the amendments, is this going to impact every board and commission that is in the statutes? Is that the plan?
I would hope eventually that it would. What we're trying to do, and we've now embedded this best business practices and governance model in two budgets, performance measures that actually one bill moved out of the Ways and Means sub today and on to full. The other one is still being worked. Whether or not I can say with authority that if we set our net to catch 100% that we'll be successful, but this is a beginning that eventually would have a much more engaged and activist participation with the advisory boards and commissions at the agency. There will be some, frankly, where their duties are described statutorily, that where there may have to be additional legislative input, but ideally we'd like to begin, as Senator Morris characterized it, changing the culture, and this begins with active board engagement and oversight of the responsibilities of the agency and the fiscal performance of the agency.
You raise an interesting question, though, Senator Starr. If you have a volunteer board, some of this needs to be done within the parameters of the time that a volunteer can give in the process. How do you address that in the first sentence of your thing where you're saying you're requiring boards and commissions to be engaged? I mean,
Mr. Chair, in response to your question, our committees did this activity today in a relatively short period of time. I think the engagement would be eventually described by each one of the agencies in a way appropriate to their boards and a way appropriate to the nature of their volunteers and the time they have to give. We heard very disturbing testimony, actually, from one agency head who said that his board simply isn't engaged at all, that he reports to them. And I would submit to you that in the time that it takes an executive director to prepare a report, which is simply a passing of information one direction, that a mechanism could be worked out to engage the board in at least some degree of oversight. I would say that it isn't onerous to review on a routine and regular basis, and many of the boards meet monthly to have them space out their oversight review in a way that appreciates the fact that many of these people are volunteers and they take away from their own revenue-producing professional lives to come down here and serve the state. I would expect agency directors to exhibit good management practices to accommodate the time demands on their board and to see that they could work this material in, either distribute it over the Internet, have it provided in packets, in some way that is not onerous. This is meant, quite frankly, not to burden the boards, but rather to lift their level of engagement, to solicit the input that they bring on any given subject matter where they're willing to serve on the board, and to give their board service a level of gravitas heretofore not recognized.
Thank you. That's very helpful. Well, I think, is there any other discussion? I think we should adjourn this hearing. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, I just want to say that this would be appropriate given the one board that we were looking at in this committee for some time, and that's the SAFE board.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It doesn't seem to have done its job.
Right. The performance review of the executive director is a case in point, maybe.
Yeah.
I would like to adjourn this hearing, have you go forth and get amendments and come on back. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
We'll be back. Senate Bill 471, the hearing is closed. And Senator Morris doesn't get to go anywhere because we're opening the hearing on Senate Bill 854. And who else is going down there? Are you by yourself down there?
I believe so, Mr. Chair. Thank you again for the record. Senate Bill 854, Frank Morris, State Senator, District 8. This bill is a bill that arose out of the initial presentation to Ways and Means, the Joint Ways and Means Committee, at the beginning of this session. When we were hearing from the Department of Administrative Services with respect to staffing ratios, and it caused some fairly significant alarms to go off in my head with respect to a ratio that was listed as 1 management to 6.27 non-management. And out of that, this bill arose, which I would suggest to you is in by no means the final form that this will take. I'll just share with you the processes that have unfolded out of this. I suggested to the co-chairs of Ways and Means that we initiate a very thoughtful review of the staffing ratios, management to non-management, supervisory to non-supervisory, within all of the agencies in our budgets. And the Department of Administrative Services has been very, very cooperative. We've received data from them. We've met. And we're in the process. This is a work in progress right now in terms of how do we craft a thoughtful process that will move these ratios where indeed it's appropriate. Because when you start breaking it down, some agencies have ratios that are certainly in the realm of what you would call adequate, there are agencies that have opportunities for improvement. So, Mr. Chair, I'm not asking for you to take action on this bill. What I'm hoping is that the amendments that will come out of the process that's ongoing in Ways and Means will allow us to bring this back in a very thoughtful way. I would like to at least correct one, and it was actually a degree of misinformation in the way it was characterized from Department of Administrative Services. The 1 to 6.27 ratio on an actual supervisory to non-supervisory ratio across all the 32,000 employees in the executive branch is 1 to 9. Now, there are those in the business world that would suggest that that's not the average that is appropriate. So, and as you can see in this bill, it was characterized as 1 to 12 being the goal. So I do appreciate this opportunity to tap this in, Mr. Chair and colleagues, and would hope that we'll be able to come back with a very thoughtful amended bill that will move this in a very positive way.
Thank you. And Senator Morris, if you don't have it, there is some written testimony that we've received from Dale Penn that you might be interested in seeing. So let's make sure that the senator, I don't think Dale is here, is he? He's just delivering this testimony today, so let's make sure Senator Morris has it, because it's part of the process as well.
Yes.
Okay. Is there any discussion that anybody wants to raise right now? In fact, we would ask that you expedite that process, because we don't know what our parameters are going to be as committees, and I think you know what I mean. So...
And Mr. Chair, it may be that this bill is not the appropriate vehicle. It may be that we originate a bill out of Ways and Means that will actually implement our work. So if we could kind of maybe hold this one.
It's not going anywhere. We'll keep it right here. Okay. We'll be in touch with you, or you be in touch with us. Thank you, Senator Morris.
Thank you.
With that, I'm going to close the hearing on Senate Bill 854. I want to say, I didn't say this out loud to the audience, but Senate Bill 963 has been pulled off the agenda today. So if you're here for that reason, please excuse yourselves. You don't need to sit here any longer. It looks to me like I've got about half an hour, 45 minutes of work before we get near the end of the agenda, at which I hope to have some conversation about some safe issues. So you've probably got a half an hour to 45 minutes to sit. If you're here for that portion of the agenda, that won't start before 4:30. I just want you to know kind of what the schedule is. And with that, I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 636. Judith?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I need to ask for your patience because we did receive the -2 amendments today and did not have a chance to hand engross those. So I'm going to be walking you through the -2 amendment, pointing out in the original bill where those amendments and what where they are and what they affect.
That's a thick bill, Mr. Chair.
Yes, that's right. I'll just start out with some of the key components of the main bill. I will point out we have a no revenue impact on the bill, and it does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. This is the measure that requires a manufactured dwelling park and floating home mortgages to register with the Housing and Community Services Department. It would require that at least one owner, manager, or person for each park complete continuing education. It expands the definition of premises for the purposes of landlord-tenant law. It specifies permissible billing methods for the delivery of utility or service to the tenant. And it prohibits local governments from placing a limit on the placement or length of a recreational vehicle if certain conditions are met. Those are just some of the key provisions of Senate Bill 636.
Now, do you have to walk us through every line of this?
I don't have to do that, Mr. Chair. That's your prerogative. We have the -2 amendments that just came out of council today.
You know,
go ahead.
Probably Mr. Van Landingham is the one who could give us the short and sweet version of what the -2s are.
And if you all you guys want to come up and nod your heads together in unison and say amen, I can send this on to, right?
Ways and Means.
Ways and Means. But, John, do you want to take a stab at a brief telling us what all these dots and dashes and page 2, 22, 41, 39, et cetera, add up to?
Thank you, Senator. John Van Landingham from Lane County Law and Advocacy Center in Eugene. There are about 40 changes in the -2. All but five of them are something that only a neurotic like me or legislative counsel would care about. For example, should it say in or for, or class versus program? There are five substantive changes here, and they're all negotiated between the coalition with me doing the negotiation and electric utilities, electric co-ops, and the PUC. So there are only five substantive changes
right
here.
Right, guys?
That's why they're nodding their head yes.
They're nodding their head. They're agreeing.
Their head.
Okay.
Yes. And all of those are designed to make sure that the submetering issue, one of the three issues that you described, that the submetering issue does not mess with utility, policy, or procedure. That's the short answer. I can describe those five specific changes if you want. They can get a little detailed, but they're simply to make sure that with our intent, we're not monkeying with utility policy?
As you recall, we heard this bill. Everybody sitting back in the back row was in here in agreement on all the negotiations that went forth. These are amendments that you're welcome to ask questions about. John could describe each of the five if you want those described, rather than the other 40. What's the pleasure of the committee?
I have a question, John. It is in the amendment, it says, let's see, it's on page 5, I believe, line 11, delete prior notice or consent and insert consent of the tenant and without notice to the tenant.
Where is that on these amendments?
That has to do with the installation of the meters, I presume.
Senator Shields, Senator Berger, it does not have to do with the installation of the meters.
Not.
It has to do with reading the meters. And the actual, I'm sorry, in the bill itself, it's on page 5, line 11, as Senator Berger mentioned. In the dash 2s, it would be on the second page, line 17.
Line 17?
Yeah, of the dash 2 amendments. Page 2, line 17 and 18, deletes prior notice or consent and inserts consent of the tenant and without notice to the tenant. And the reason the change is being made is to make this language consistent with an existing statute, 90.722, that regulates access. So there's already an existing statute that controls a landlord's ability to access, to walk onto the space.
To read the meter.
Well,
no?
In this bill, we're going to allow the landlord, if it passes, allow the landlord to either himself or herself or an employee enter the space without it giving advance notice, only for the purpose of reading the meter. And the rationale there is that landlords frequently will use a meter reading company. And that meter, it's hard for the meter reading company or the landlord to know in advance to give the 24-hour notice. Under current law, before a landlord can enter an apartment or a space, the landlord has to give 24 hours notice saying, I'm coming over tomorrow at 3 o'clock to fix your top plumbing. Well, they won't have to give that just to read the meter, but that would be the only thing that they wouldn't have to give advance notice for.
So it's no different than any house, essentially. I mean, the meter reader doesn't give us notice every time he comes to read our electric meter.
Right, and the meter is on the outside of the unit, but as Senator Berger would understand, tenants in parks are sensitive about someone entering the space because here the space is the yard or the equivalent of the yard.
And
Senator Berger?
Follow up, and it's a small yard. Let me ask now the cost. I had inquired about that, and I believe someone told me that it was $200. No. Per meter, how much
Senator
is
Shields, Senator Berger, what we were told by the PUC, Rick Willis of the PUC, was that the typical cost to buy and install a submeter is $50 to $100.
$50 to $100.
And you remember at our hearing on March 10th, you were concerned about our effort to try to regulate how that gets passed on to the tenants. It would be passed
That's
on
right.
to tenants, but it would be not for 6 months, and it would have to be part of the rent. And so our answer to you now is that we're not talking about much money.
Okay.
Are there other questions?
Mr. Chair, that was the only questions that we raised at the
right.
last hearing were the ones by Representative Senator Berger.
What I would like to do is have an amendment relative to the dash 2 amendments, forget dash 1, a motion. Don't ask me what I said. You know what I meant. excuse me. Just being a wise guy today.
Mr. Chairman,
yes.
I'd like to move the dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 636.
Senator George moves the proposed amendments to Senate Bill dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 636. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Thank you very much. Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to recommend that we move Senate Bill 636 as amended to the Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation.
Senator George moves that we move Senate Bill 636 to the Ways and Means Committee as amended.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any question, any objection? Or shall I call the roll on this one?
That's all right, Mr. Chair. I'm going to not object to it going to the Ways and Means with no promise of what I'll do when it comes back into the budget.
Okay. Okay. Then yes, go ahead.
And Mr. Chair, I just wanted to thank the coalition and Mr. Van Landingham because he's a very good mediator. Mm-hmm. And they saved us a lot of time and angst by not having to bicker about this in the legislative process.
I want to be sure I complete my process here. Further discussion? Is there any objection? So ordered. And with that, we can now close the hearing on Senate Bill 636. And we're going to open a hearing on Senate Bill 995. Judith, you're going to give us a brief update. Let's see, we've had a hearing on this before, right?
Thank you, Mr. Chair members. Senate Bill 995 exempts the state treasurer from state personnel relations law, and it requires the state treasurer to adopt a system of personnel administration. The Dash 1 amendments you also have in your possession, and that does the exact same thing with respect to the Secretary of State's office, exempting the Secretary of State from the personnel relations law and instead requiring that they establish a personnel administration system. We have received a no revenue and a no fiscal impact on the original bill and the Dash 1 amendments. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, let's see. I'm just going to invite all three people that are here, Linda, Cynthia, and Jen, representing Treasury, and Secretary of State. As I understand it, the difference between the Secretary of State and the Treasury and all other statewide offices and so on that are under DAS, like, you know, whether it's the Attorney General or Boley or whoever, is that these are constitutional. And if somebody wants to talk about that for just a second, it kind of sets a helpful context.
Chair Shields, members of the committees, I'm Cynthia Burns. I'm with the Attorney General's office, and I represent the Office of the State Treasurer as my client.
Why don't you pull that mic over a little bit?
I had actually planned to sort of give a little overview, so I'll go ahead and do that. As I'm sure you know, the Constitution establishes an executive branch of government, which is the governor is the head of, and then it has in Article 4 what's called the administrative branch, which is comprised of the Secretary of State and the State Treasurer. So those are the two constitutional officers. And the workings of the state government, those offices have been largely independent. Much of that independence has been based on some advice that was given by our office in the early 1950s when the forerunner of what is now DAS was established, and there was a bill that was giving budgetary control to the governor over the offices of the Secretary of State, over all state agencies, and within that definition was the Secretary of State and the State Treasurer, along with the courts and the judiciary. So at that time, our office issued a whole series of opinions dealing with that bill, and what we said in those opinions was that the constitutional language gives the governor, it establishes a relationship where the governor works cooperatively with the Secretary of State and the Treasurer. They report information to him, but he does not have the authority to exercise internal control over the functioning of their offices, that those constitutional officers are responsible to the people who elected them in the performance of their duties and not subject to much internal control of the governor's office. So that sort of set the framework for a number of statutes were enacted thereafter. If you look through the statutes, there are a number of provisions where they give a definition of state agency, which is basically any agency that's funded with monies from the state treasury, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Then you get down to the bottom and it says, except for the state courts, the Secretary of State, and the state treasurer. And all those statutes are sort of, I think, traceable back to this original series of 1950 opinions. So what has happened over the course of time, the Treasurer's Office from the beginning in terms of salary and appointing personnel has been largely independent, subject only to appropriation authority by the Legislative Assembly. In 1945, the Civil Service Act was enacted, which created what's the forerunner of Chapter 240. The treasurer was subject in part to some of that. In 1953, when the statutes were revised into their current codification, the code reviser put in a statutory link to the, from the treasurer's office to what is now Chapter 240. And what has happened over the years is Chapter 240 has been amended and evolved to a larger scope than it was in the 1940s. The Treasurer's Office and the Secretary of State, it's my understanding, have continued to react and have a relationship with DAS based primarily on those that historical understanding that the Treasurer's Office and the Secretary of State are largely independent in their internal functioning from the Office of the Governor. So I hope that's helpful to you. That's sort of the history of where we are.
Okay. Questions, comments?
Ms. Chair, I just want to make sure, under this bill, you're still going to be paying into DAS for the different services or not? I mean, under 240, 165, and 167?
I believe the way the bill is structured, we went through, and there are some things that DAS assists the Treasurer's Office with now. For instance, the SEIU, collective bargaining. Mm-hmm. If things happen that need to be, if there's a labor conflict under that, it goes to ERB. So the Treasurer's Office would still pay its percentage, its assessment to ERB, because it would use ERB for those services.
I'm sorry,
Employment Relations Board. It's the board that after you go through the appeal process, if someone's disciplined or let go, then they make the final decision. So for employees subject to the collective bargaining, under which the Employment Relations Board would be the appropriate deciding authority, Treasury would still use them and they would pay the appropriate fees. The way this is structured for employees who are not represented, it would go through a hearings process, and the hearings panel officers that are established in Chapter 183, and there's a separate assessment process under that, so that's how those proceedings would be paid for. And I don't know if there's other assessments that you're going to use DAS for.
Personnel actually tracking. Mr.
Go ahead.
Linda Haglund, Deputy State Treasurer. To the question of other services it would be using with DAS, the bill does provide us to still use DAS and their actual personnel system, so the computer systems that keep track of our staff, that aspect of it. So we'd be paying for that also.
Okay.
And I can't speak to the Secretary of State. Same thing.
We've been kind of nibbling around the edges. Let's get to the heart of it. What does this bill mean to you? What does it do for Treasurer? And the same question to the Secretary of State's office.
Mr. Chair, good question. From a process standpoint, it really doesn't do anything. As Cynthia indicated,
let me interrupt you there, except
yes,
it kind of codifies what you've been doing.
Exactly.
I don't
exactly
want that part of the sentence left out. You understand what I'm saying here? Okay, go ahead.
It's how the agencies have related and acted for the last, since the mid-50s. So it's continued practice. What this does, what's happened is there's been some questions asked with turnover at DAS. We've been looking at 240, noticed that there was some inconsistencies in the chapter, and felt that the best way to actually codify, as you stated, Mr. Chair, practices that had been in place was to clear up statute.
I would never accuse DAS of losing its memory, but that's part of what this is about. It's to put it in, mm-hmm, in statute so everybody mm-hmm is on the same page and nobody forgets what the rules are.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right?
That's right.
Okay.
Right.
Continue.
Okay. So, again, nothing is going to be done differently in the agencies. Both systems are based on merit principles, which is the standard by which different personnel systems are set up, and those include basically you pay somebody for their worth of their job, and there is a mechanism for appeal and resolution of grievances. So that has always been in place in Treasury as well as in DAS. We have our own set of principles already in place, policies and procedures. Those would continue. The biggest change is that this would, again, codify the practices of the agencies that have existed over time. Without it, it could leave us in a situation where the governor is the boss of the treasurer and the secretary of state. And as Cynthia indicated earlier about the separation of the offices, there's a number of duties that are assigned to our respective offices, the governor's office, the treasurer, and the secretary of state, that are unique to those offices. And some of the founding reasons for those being housed in those agencies separately is the accountability then of those two agencies back to the citizens, but also separation of control within the state system, separate from the governor. So there is almost a little bit of a balance of power in those roles. So it would be codifying some of that legislative intent also.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jen Coney. I am the Director of Human Resources for the Secretary of State's office. And both Cynthia and Linda have very succinctly summarized the impact that this would have on the Secretary of State's office as well. What we're trying to do with this bill, with the Dash 1 amendments, is maintain the status quo and clearly define our role in relationship to our relationship with the Department of Administrative Services Human Resources Division. We work with them. We will continue to work with them. This is not changing the way that we do business.
And Mr. Chair, if I might also clarify for the record, in case there's a question of who's covered by this bill, it's management and unclassified or executive service staff. All of our classified employees in Treasury are represented, and they'd be covered by their collective bargaining agreement.
That's an important point to make. And as far as the Dash 1 amendments, they're just kind of the Me Too amendments?
They're Me Too amendments, Mr. Okay. Chair.
Questions? Discussion? Are we clear here? Gee, we're
clear.
Pull it down.
Clear.
Gee. Mr. Vice Chair, I guess what I should do. Hang on a minute. What should I do? I should close the hearing. We're going to close the hearing on Senate Bill 995, and we're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 995. We'll leave them there in case we have any questions, but go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to move the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 995.
Senator George moves the Dash 1 Me Too amendment to Senate Bill 995. Is there any discussion of that? Are we clear on what we're doing?
We must clarify the Constitution and treat each of the entities equally.
That's true. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? So ordered.
Senator George would like to carry that.
Well, let's move on.
All right.
Now that we've done the amendments, let's do the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm moving this to the floor with a due pass recommendation. All right. Senate Bill 995 is amended with Dash 1 amendments. I would like to move to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator George moves Senate Bill 995 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion, any further discussion, any questions? If not, so ordered, and in fact, yes, Senator George can do it, since you assigned it to him. Okay.
I love the constitutional part of it. So.
Yeah, you love the constitutional part of it.
I just thought I'd jazz him up a little bit.
Without objection, it passes. I didn't say that. I thought I said that. That's what I've got you there for. Make sure I don't make any screw mistakes. Thank you very much. I'll let a whole bunch of you leave, I guess, unless you want to hang around. It's so much fun around here. Let's see. That brings us up to Senate Bill 477. Would you like to tell us about 477?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Excuse me, Mr.
Madam Chair.
I have my other
chair. Yeah, your other chair is on the other side. Do you want to take my place?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 477 requires specifications for subcontracts for public works to contain provisions on prevailing wage rates. It prohibits a public agency from paying a contractor on public works until the contractor files a certified payroll statements with the agency, and prohibits the contractor from paying subcontractors on public works until the subcontractor, in fact, files certified payroll statements with the agency as well. We have received a no revenue impact, and we're still waiting on word from fiscal on Senate Bill 477. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I've got three or four folks signed up here. Let's get Dan Gardner and Company up here. Ed Glad up here. I guess I better not crowd the table too much, so I'll bring some more up when I get you guys done. Mr. Gardner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dan Gardner, Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries. Senate Bill 477 before you today is an effort to look at ways to streamline prevailing wage and potential investigations. With me is Christy Hammond, who's the head of the Wage and Hour Division, where the prevailing wage unit is housed, and she can give you some details and outline on the bill.
Go ahead.
Thank you. Chair Shields, members of the committee, my name is Christine Hammond. I'm the administrator of the Wage and Hour Division for the Bureau of Labor and Industries, and I'm here to testify on behalf of the Bureau regarding Senate Bill 477. And you have before you a letter from Commissioner Gardner pertaining to this bill. The Bureau supports this bill and urges you to pass this legislation. The Bureau of Labor and Industries administers and enforces the prevailing wage rate law, which applies to public works construction projects in this state. The Bureau investigates approximately 200 prevailing wage rate projects annually, and last biennium we collected over $1.7 million in unpaid prevailing wage rates for workers employed on those projects. The current provisions of the prevailing wage rate law requires that contracts between a public agency and a contractor for a public work contain the requirement that the prevailing wage rate law applies and is required to be complied with on that project. The contracts between a public agency and a general contractor also are required to actually physically contain the applicable prevailing wage rates that must be paid on that project. The law, however, does not require that contractors provide that same information to subcontractors, so there's no current requirement that contractors notify their subcontractors that the prevailing wage rate law applies, nor are prime contractors required to provide the rates to be paid by subcontractors on public works projects. In many of the cases that we investigate, particularly involving subcontractors on public works projects, the subcontractors tell us that they didn't know that a project was subject to the prevailing wage rate law and further weren't put on notice about what rates needed to be paid on that project. Senate Bill 477 would require all contracts subject to the prevailing wage rate law, including subcontracts, to specify that the prevailing wage rate law apply and include the applicable wage rates to be paid on the project. We believe that requiring such notices would reduce, if not eliminate, the occurrence of unwary contractors employing workers on projects subject to the law without the contractor's knowledge. In addition, requiring that the applicable wage rates be incorporated in all contracts subject to the law, including subcontracts, would serve to help level the playing field between contractors and assure that contractors who employ workers on public works projects subject to the law know what rates must be paid to the workers employed on the project, minimizing inadvertent violations by contractors. Another critical provision in the prevailing wage rate law is the requirement for all contractors employed on public works projects to submit certified payroll reports to the public agency administering the project. and you have a copy of the certified payroll report attached to the letter from Commissioner Gardner. The provision of certified payrolls is to ensure that all workers employed on public works projects are being paid the applicable prevailing wage rates. The certified payroll form requires a certified statement by the contractor attesting to the fact that they are paying the prevailing wage rate. And these reports are required to be submitted to the contracting agency both by the general contractor and any and all subcontractors on the project. This information is invaluable to the Bureau when we're conducting an investigation because we can quickly see what rates the contractors are certifying that they're paying on the project and compare those to any of the payroll records or other information that were provided during the course of an investigation. Although contractors may be assessed a civil penalty for failing to file certified payroll reports as required with the contracting agency, contracting agencies are under no requirement to collect those reports and frequently do not. It is our experience that in many cases where violations of the law are determined, the contracting agency has failed to require the submission of certified payroll reports and the contractor has failed to file those reports. It is our belief that many violations of the law could be avoided if the contracting agency insisted on contractors filing these required reports. Senate Bill 477 would prohibit a contracting agency from paying a contractor on a public works project subject to the law until the contractor has complied by filing all the required certified payroll reports with the agency. In addition, the bill would prohibit a contractor from paying a subcontractor before verifying that the subcontractor has filed the required reports with the contracting agency. We are convinced that requiring verification that prevailing wages have been paid by requiring these certified payroll reports before paying contractors on public works projects would serve as a significant deterrent to violations of the prevailing wage rate law, as well as enhance compliance with the law and our ability to quickly resolve complaints and information we receive about violations. Thank you again for your consideration of this bill, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
And Mr. Chair, if I might, one of the things that I might add is there you'll see some other bills within the system, within the legislature, for instance, too, that address accelerated investigations by the prevailing wage unit to see that we move along faster with investigations. One of the biggest things, as Christy was saying, that slows down the system is not being able to get those certified payrolls quickly enough, have them accurately, have them at fingertips. It can often take weeks, if not months, to get those certified payrolls. By having the ability to not have a payment prior to, having those certified payrolls to the contracting agency, our investigations will increase radically, not holding up, therefore, the prime contractor's bond and other issues. I know there are some organizations that have some severe concern about the withholding of payment, and I do want to state for the record that the Bureau of Labor and Industry is always ready, willing, and able to work with those concerns and see if we can do some things to alleviate those concerns or find an approach that's agreeable.
Okay. Senator Verger.
Yeah. One of the things that I don't believe many subcontractors know that they don't have to pay prevailing wage when they're on a job. They would have a hard time pulling one off like me, telling me something like that. But I guess the one thing that I want to know about this bill is how responsible is the contractor when the subcontractor doesn't do their job? In other words, when the contractor in good faith makes all of these contracts, the subs, it's a big project, they're busy, but they do everything right. You get a certified statement from them and they do everything right. The subcontractor's no better. He's told them, given them all the information, but they don't do it. Is he in some way in this bill now responsible for anything of that subcontract fails to do?
Well, Chair Shields and Senator Verger, the prime contractor is already liable for the unpaid wages of subcontractors by virtue of the prime contractor's bond. We first always try to collect the wages due from a subcontractor, but the law does provide a remedy to workers that have not been paid by a subcontractor through the bond of a prime contractor. This doesn't change that. This would require the prime contractor to verify that the subcontractor has filed the certified payrolls before the prime contractor pays the subcontractor. So that may, in fact, relieve the contractor of some liability if they catch those violations before the it becomes clear that the sub has not appropriately paid the sub's workers.
Mr. Chair and Senator, if I could add just a couple of quick things. One is you have to remember that the general contractor, the prime contractor, is the one with the bond. It's always been a controversial issue within the legislature whether subcontractors should be required to have bonds or not, and cost incurred and how much it would incur, increase costs within a prevailing wage project. But I do want to absolutely agree with Senator Verger on the fact that most contractors do know when it's a prevailing wage project. I do remember touring a couple of years ago a temporary employment agency that tried to tell me that part of the reason they were in trouble on prevailing wage projects was that their contractors that they send people out to didn't tell them it was prevailing wage. And my first comment was, you sent them to Oak Grove School. What'd you think wasn't prevailing wage?
Right.
You know, I mean, most prevailing wage projects are the county of, the city of,
yeah,
courthouse or city hall or, you know, so-and-so school district. When it's a school, it's a county building.
Yeah.
I think the average person with even a limited intelligence could, you know, understand that's a prevailing wage project.
Okay, so I want to be clear that I understand it, Mr. Chair. In other words, in the law now, when the contractor is bonded and the subcontractor fails to pay, then the contract, they come back on the contractor. That's what you're telling me.
Senator Berger, okay. That's correct.
That's already in law.
Correct.
Okay.
I might also mention one other scenario that does occasionally occur where a subcontractor may legitimately not be aware that they're on a public works project, and that's where their part of the project is less than $25,000, which is the threshold for prevailing wage rate coverage, and they don't know the full cost of a project. And if they're working on a smaller type of project, and no one tells them the contract price or specifically tells them that the law applies, they may not know.
I know we have a couple more questions. I want to remind the committee that this is a hearing only.
Mm-hmm.
If we do anything, it'll be back for more questions. We have one other bill that I have to at least listen to for a moment or two. And then we have some safe stuff that I'd like to talk about. So let's keep moving. Senator George, your turn.
I'm okay. I'll ask the question later.
Oh, okay. Questions at this end?
I'll wait till later.
Okay. I have a couple other people, Jessica and Ed. Come on up. I'll take your testimony on this bill.
For the record, my name is Ed Glad. Thank you for having the opportunity to speak to you today about prevailing wage. Today was the day that I ponied up my $18 for the Blue Book, Oregon Blue Book, this version. And just like every year that I buy an issue, I go to the page that started me working beyond being an informed voter to actually getting involved in politics, which is November 8th, 1994. We had a prevailing wage repeal initiative that the entire state voted on, and it turns out that the repeal was turned down. Some people would say barely, but I can demonstrate to you by the record in the Secretary of State's office that every single county in the state of Oregon voted to uphold and maintain the prevailing wage law. With that, in the last 10 years, 33% of the Bureau of Labor and Industry's capacity to investigate wage and hour violations in the state of Oregon, 33% we've cut back the Bureau of Labor and Industry's. Their ability to actually enforce the prevailing wage law has been, in my mind, eviscerated. And that brings me to the last point. which is very timely. Last night I was driving home, and my mentoree, the fellow that the young carpenter out of Hillsboro that I've been bringing along since he was an apprentice, called me. This is his first job as a superintendent. He says, "You will not believe what had happened to him this last week." I said, "What's that?" He says, "We had 34 drywallers that were working on the job last week in up in Columbia County. 34 drywallers. Not one of them spoke English. Not one of them was in the union. Doesn't matter. Our union rep, who actually speaks Spanish, went to visit this member of our local in Hillsboro. And as he was walking out, he was talking to a couple of the drywallers in Spanish. And it turns out that it's a prevailing wage job. And he asked them, "What are you getting paid?" They said, $9 an hour. $9 an hour. That was on Thursday. On Friday, that crew did not show up. And they were brought in on Saturday, and they finished the job up, and nobody showed up on Monday except for four English speakers. The crew had been fired, dismissed, because word had gotten out that, in fact, they were not getting paid prevailing wages. And in order to be able to avoid the investigation, if you get rid of the guys and you have a different certified payroll, you can prove that part of your certified payroll was that. We have problems, and we are unable to investigate because we don't want to have the investigative regulatory agency have the manpower to go out on the jobs and track down some of the complaints that are out there. This bill puts it in order that says you're working on a prevailing wage job, you're going to keep certified payrolls, you're going to submit those certified payrolls, and if we do have to go back and determine whether or not everything is copacetic, then all the paperwork is there, and it's possible to do that tracking with the capacities that we have at the Bureau of Labor and Industries. With that, I thank you. I'm sorry you're not going to move this bill today. I would like to see you move this bill today and move it on to the Senate and all the way through this August legislature to be signed by the governor, because it is actually a very good idea. Thank you. I'll answer any questions.
Just don't call us in August, Bobby. We want to be out of here in July.
June. Chair Shields, member of the committee, for the record, my name is Jessica Adamson. I'm here today on behalf of the Associated General Contractors, and I would be thrilled to go home in June. As to this,
for you,
bill,
will be August.
First of all, AGC has been a strong proponent of the prevailing wage system. We encourage all of our members not only to pay the applicable prevailing wage, but to strictly follow the law. And so we in no way support the kind of practices that Mr. Glad was just referring to. It's not appropriate. That's not being a good member of the industry. And we encourage our members to do what's right by their workers. As for this bill, we appreciate what the agency, what BOLI is trying to do in terms of moving their investigations along. It is a burden on a contractor to have their bond have a claim for an extended period of time. So we appreciate the agency's willingness to work on this issue. It's very important to us. The bill itself and the goals it's trying to achieve, we understand and we appreciate those. We have some technical concerns about the way the bill addresses those problems, the paperwork that is incurred in trying to attach the prevailing wage rates that are applicable, as opposed to explaining that there is it is a prevailing wage job, which contractors, it's in their interest that they do so, again, because it's their bond that's at risk if a sub does not pay the correct prevailing wages. Additionally, the withholding components in Section 2, we have some concerns for subcontractors. If a general contractor does not pay or does not submit their certified statements, the bill says that a public agency may not pay any amount to the contractor. Well, that would include the subcontractor's wages, and by law we aren't required to pay until we're paid. That would be, I mean, we can understand what they're trying to do in terms of withholding the portion that the contractor should be owed, but in terms of what that does to subcontractors and sub-subcontractors and material suppliers, we have concerns about that component, and then additionally putting the burden on the contractor to try and determine when and if all the subcontractors have submitted their certified statements, and then withholding from the contractor's perspective. Again, we're concerned about the interplay of the prompt payment law and this bill and what they're trying to do and trying to protect ourselves from a situation where we're incurring liability, which we believe Boley didn't intend to do here. We are happy to work with Boley to try and make this bill work in a way that's fair to everyone and resolves those concerns.
Thank you. Senator George.
Mr. Chairman, that was my question. Jessica, we're working on a project here, and I have these subcontractors, and I'm running about 60% materials and about 40% labor, and all of a sudden I have somebody down the chain who doesn't get these reports in there, but I've got to pay for that stuff. Sure. Is that a real risk relative to the way this is written?
Senator George, we believe so. Again, we believe that Boley didn't intend to do that. And in my conversations with them in the back of the room, that's not their intention. But we don't believe that innocent parties who have behaved in the way they ought to behave should be held up for those that have not followed the rules. And so what we would like to work with them on, and what my contractors agree, is it ought to be withheld for the person who didn't pay didn't submit their certified statements, but it ought not affect the people down the chain or up the chain if they did do what they were supposed to do.
Follow up on that.
Senator George.
Why not isolate it just to the wages, too? The percentage estimate of what that cost was. Because, I mean, that can kill you. I know contractors have gone broke because something went wrong, and they had those payments that had to go out.
Chair Shields, Senator George, we believe we can work on that. Again, trying to figure out how you handle wages against material suppliers. Often those materials, again, you have a purchase order or a subcontract with those entities, and you can parse that out. And for a general contractor, you can do what's called joint checking so that you make sure that it stops where it's supposed to stop, but it gets to where it's supposed to go. So that mechanism is in place today and happens all the time. We'd like to see that as part of this bill so that it works. We aren't hurting folks that have behaved in the way that they're supposed to, and we don't end up unintentionally running afoul of the public prompt payment law either.
Thank you. Any other discussion?
I'll save it for later, Mr.
Yes.
Chair.
Okay. Representative Hansen wanted to make some very quick comments. As he's coming up, I want to point out that we still have Senate Bill 578, and then we have some interested parties that want to have a little conversation about SAFE for a little bit. So let's keep our questions to a minimum.
Okay. Your eyes are getting heavy. You're getting sleepy. You're going into work session.
Can't do it. We just have a hearing. That's only scheduled for a hearing today. Nice try.
I will be very brief. I worked in the construction field back when I did honest work before I got involved in politics.
Yeah, we remember that.
This bill, with some cooperation, will work. It's going to smooth the process down. It's going to make sure that Oregonians get the wages that they deserve for working on these projects. The basic principle of prevailing wage is governments have to go to low bid. If you don't use if it's the basic device that levels the playing field between a lot of contractors so that we're not getting to the low bid point just on the back of the people that are working there. This could be a very effective tool at helping to smooth out the problems in prevailing wage and making it more effective and making the system work. Thank you.
And it sounds like we've got a little bit of cooperating to do to get across the finish line. Dan knows what that is, Jessica knows what that is, and a few others, and I expect to hear from you soon. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. And with that, I'm going to close the hearing on Senate Bill 477 and open a hearing on 578. And Judith is real quick going to give us some information, and I'm going to ask each of the five people that have signed up to try to keep your comments to 3 or 4 minutes. We're going to spend about 15 minutes on this bill before we move on to some other stuff that we got to do. Okay? Judith?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 578 makes findings concerning international outsourcing of services contracted by state agencies. It requires contractors submitting bids or proposals on public contracts to certify where those services would be performed. It prohibits a state agency from awarding a contract to a contractor that would perform services outside the United States except for particular circumstances named. And it permits the contracting agency to, in fact, bring civil action for breach of contract. We have received a no revenue impact. We're still waiting for word on fiscal. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I'm going to ask Dugan Petty if he'll come up first, and Tim Nesbitt to come on up with him. I may step out of the room just for a moment and hand the gavel to the vice chair during your testimony, but go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Dugan Petty. I'm the Deputy Administrator with the State Services Division and the Department of Administrative Services. We have been working in the interim and even during the session on the issue of offshore outsourcing and looking at ways that we might do more effective contracting. This bill, we are neutral on at this point, but have some suggestions for improvements to the bill. We've talked to the Department of Justice about it, and we think that there are really two minefields around public contracting as it relates to international offshoring. One of the minefields is the relationship to the federal government around the treaty obligations that the state of Oregon has signed up for. One of those, the only one that the state of Oregon has signed up for, has been in the Barbara Roberts administration in 1993 when the General Agreement on Tariff and Trade was signed on to by the state of Oregon. And the commitment that the governor made of the state of Oregon at that time was that for contracts that were solicited for the Department of Administrative Services that were in excess of the special drawing units, which at the time was 500-some-odd thousand, is now 477,000, are subject to being done in accordance with the governmental procurement agreement of the World Trade Organization, which basically means they have to be open, they have to be transparent, and you can have special provisions in there that would limit the award or the location in which the work can be done that would exclude those participating states from the signatory organizations of that. So that's one of the problems, and this bill actually runs into that because it has an outright prohibition against contracting where the work would be performed out of the state. It does allow for state agency to determine when it would not apply this, and for all those agencies under the Department of Administrative Services, that would be for all contracts over $477,000. We think a better approach to this is more of an incentive-based approach that would allow in the award decision some consideration of the benefits of the contract to Oregon businesses and workers. And we think that there may be a better solution than just an outright prohibition. The Department of Justice advises us that this bill as written and that outright prohibition could run up against two problems with the United States Constitution. One of them is the foreign commerce provision, and another one is interstate commerce. But it is the responsibility and the authority of the Department or of the United States to determine provisions of commerce between foreign governments. So there's a concern there. So we think that there may be a better approach to this. Two other areas for improvement that I think would make sense is one of them, a clearer definition of services. Does this just apply to the services that are under contract by the state, or would it apply to any service that a contractor has? So, for example, if the work is being performed directly for the benefit of the state, but that contractor also has some other element of work done by a subcontractor in another country, are we in have a problem over that? And then, secondly, it's not very clear about service. Is it all services? Is it services under a certain amount? Is it services and goods We know it's not goods, but I think there needs to be some additional clarification around service. And finally, the last area that I think would be helpful in improving this bill would be allowing for rules to be developed, probably by the Department of Administrative Services, so those rules could fit the process to carry out the intent of the bill. And I know you're pressed for time, Mr. Chairman, committee members, so I'll leave my comments at that.
Thank you. Tim?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Tim Nesbitt, appearing for the Oregon AFL-CIO in support of the bill as drafted and also encouraged by the work we've been doing with Mr. Petty to come up with some amendments that might be better suited to address the problem. If I can just state the problem.
Okay, do.
When you connect phone lines and high-speed internet lines to workers in low-wage countries who are willing to work for dollars a day, you end up with the loss of significant jobs from our own country and our own state. And you all have seen the data. Let me just quote a couple of points. Goldman Sachs estimates that 400,000 to 600,000 professional services and information jobs have moved overseas in the past few years. And there's a UC Berkeley study which found that 25 to 30,000 new outsourcing-related jobs advertised in India in any given month last year were jobs likely to be taken from the United States. States as well are experiencing the problem. I mean, we had our own experience contracting with an Arizona firm who ends up shifting their call center work to India, and we end up then having call center workers in that country answering questions from food stamp recipients in Oregon. That's since been corrected. The work's been brought back to the United States. But the question then is whether the state and cities and counties should participate in such outsourcing just to get a cheaper contract without regard to what it means for our citizens to lose job opportunities, what it means for our families and communities to lose those incomes represented by those jobs, and what it means for our state and our cities and counties and school districts to lose the tax revenue associated with having those jobs in our state. You know, one answer to this question is contained in the bill as drafted. Just say no. Prohibit outsourcing. We can work through the minefield of trade agreements, those we intended to apply, those we've since said will not apply to Oregon. Another is to try and come up with a scheme that will take into account properly the kind of payroll a contractor might have in the state of Oregon or in the United States and kind of give credit to anybody asking for a business by taking a measure of their commitment to employment in Oregon, which benefits all of us and benefits our tax receipts as well. That's the alternative approach we're working on, and we hope we can bring that back shortly, maybe as early as next week. We're still showing the draft to others. But in either direction, we think this is a problem that needs to be addressed, and we're hoping to get your support to do so.
Well, I certainly appreciate the way you guys are working on this. We have other testimony that I hope you'll stick around and listen to. Jim Craven and Paul Cosgrove have a perspective they'd like to bring to the issue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Jim Craven representing the American Electronics Association. Mr. Chair, it looks like we started the morning together at 7 a.m. and we're finishing together.
I don't remember that early.
Yeah, me either.
This year?
Very long day. Just a couple of real quick comments. I know you're pressed for time. And I think Dugan Petty made a number of the comments about this bill as printed in terms of its potential conflicts with existing federal law and international law, and I think those need to be listened to, and I think there's some opinions from the Attorney General's office that this bill as printed potentially has some big major road mines in it. We are aware of the issue that came up last year with the firm that managed the Oregon Trail Card program, and as Mr. Nesbitt pointed out, that has been rectified. We would be interested in knowing if there are additional specific examples where Oregon has contracted with services for services and those jobs have been taken offshore. I think specificity would be good in this debate. In the IT sector that I represent, it is one of the areas where the United States continues to have a very rigorous positive balance of trade. With all the other talk about loss of manufacturing jobs and other things, in the IT service sector, United States comes out ahead to the tune of about $60 billion a year to the net. With our growing trade deficit in America, it is one sector where actually we're still ahead in serving our, in selling our services globally. I think the key issue in this bill is the blanket prohibition on a firm that would, say, provide a multi-year information technology consulting contract to the state of Oregon, help us rewrite our software, or something like that. I mean, as printed, what this bill says is that even if I had a firm domiciled in the United States or even domiciled here in Oregon, and I even had employees in other countries, as increasingly firms do, who were going to work or contribute to that project, not offshore jobs to low-wage subcontractors, but even employees of a Hewlett-Packard or an IBM or a Microsoft or whatever, located in a foreign country, who were going to participate in that, serving that contract, that firm would be prohibited from bidding to the state. So I think you've heard from Mr. Petty that, you know, we're pursuing other alternatives to this bill as printed, so I don't want to belabor testifying against the bill as printed. We do have concerns about the general topic, and we'll look forward to whatever proposals come subsequently.
Sounds like you, Mr. Petty, Tim, and others are going to be talking.
We have been, Mr. Chair.
I'm going to ask Judith to ride herd on this, frankly, because I've got so many other bills on my plate.
And Mr. Chair, just the final, I think we do need, last session we had a huge, and I wasn't a big participant in that huge knockdown, drag out public procurement rewrite, I think some people in this room were. We do have to remember that there's another side to this story. There's certainly a position, as advanced by Mr. Nesbitt, that is certainly valid. And the other side of the story is the state of Oregon, when it procures services, meeting the needs of the service that it needs to provide at the best cost to the Oregon taxpayers. And if you too limit the funnel of potential bidders on any kind of personal service contract, you potentially limit the people with the best solutions and the people who can, quite frankly, give you the best cost to save taxpayer dollars to spend on other things that are priorities. So, thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to ask Dan to come forward, too, even as Paul starts to speak, just to cut down on the time lag.
Mr. Chairman, Paul Cosgrove, representing Oregon Financial Services Association, and due to the limitation on time and the changes in fluidity of this bill, I'll just give you one example of the issues that financial services firms have with respect to bills like this. And it's the other side of the coin. One of the members of our association is a company called HSBC North America. That stands for the shortened name of Hong Kong and Shanghai Bank, which actually isn't in Hong Kong or Shanghai, although they have branches there. It's in London with its major base of operations in the United States in Albany, not New York City. And it has outsourced 1,000 jobs to Tigard, Oregon from Great Britain. This goes both ways, and it's something I think we need to keep in mind as we are talking about Oregon's international competitiveness. We seek foreign investment in this state, and it puts us in somewhat a difficult position sometimes when we talk about we're only going to take that one side of the street. So I just wanted to let that perspective be part of the record.
Now, by no means were you implying when you said outsourced to Tigard, Oregon, that they're a foreign country. You weren't foreign.
No, Mr. Chairman. Foreign Tigard government. Is by no means foreign.
Okay.
Unless you live in Hillsborough, I suppose.
Uh-oh. Now you're in trouble over here. Any comments? Yes, Dan, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dan Gardner, Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries, and outsourcing is a subject I've been involved in many panels on over the last couple of years, as this particular phenomenon has radically and dramatically grown. While there may be a rare example, such as the Tigard, Oregon situation, studies and data continue to show us, for instance, there's a study by Cornell that shows that 1,349 Oregon jobs were lost due to outsourcing just in the first 3 months of 2004.
Give us that statistic again.
1,349 in the first 3 months of the calendar year 2004. And if Mr. Cravens and others would like specific examples, there was a Sears Roebuck call center in the town I live in, Milwaukee, Oregon, where actually that was outsourced outsourced to India and lost nearly 300 jobs right there, that are family wage jobs that are tax-paying citizens to their local community, to this state, and they're now either on unemployment or underemployed. Although this state seems to be coming out of the economic recession, look at the jobs that are being created, not only nationally but locally as well, that are lower paid, lower skilled, less benefits, such as health care and retirement. And I would think that since Oregon's experienced this outsourcing riptide in the forest product industry, in manufacturing and construction, and among many other industries, that I think as elected officials of the state of Oregon, that it's our duty to champion continued investment in Oregon jobs, in Oregon businesses, and in Oregon workers. And I believe that in living in our great state affords us many luxuries, including a quality of life we must vigilantly protect. And I urge you as policymakers of the state to support the economic investment in Oregon, and together we can hold back the tide and stand back and allow the path of least resistance, which threatens Oregon's competitive edge and marketability. I think that we need to have a commitment to make sure that there are protections for workers that aren't in many of these other nations, such as unemployment insurance, workers' compensation, and other protections as well, including child labor laws and many others. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any questions of this illustrious witness?
A comment, Mr. Chair, and that is that it's a little bit different situation, but there are entire cities in our country today that are almost ghost towns because the people there lost all of their jobs in the automobile industry. Mm-hmm. And as hard as they tried to get people to buy American to keep those jobs, they failed to do that. And now many of them, and you've seen those on documentaries on television, are on state services.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
They are, Mr. Chair, and I'd certainly add one other item just for, just for particular references, that I believe as a state we need to do more things to invest in American manufactured goods, and that's why even when we purchase more cars as from the Bureau of Labor and Industries and the Department of Administrative Services, I've required them to be the most American-made cars we can get.
Thank you very much. I'm going to close the hearing on Senate Bill 578, and I want to have a discussion with those people that are still here that must be interested in issues of relevance to SAFE. I have tried very hard to be as fair as I can to everyone. I don't want to limit anybody's access to this committee. On Thursday, I am asking for, how did I put it in the agenda, for invited testimony. If you want to be invited to testify on anything related to SAFE, please see Judith. I don't want to open it up for the whole universe, another public hearing per se, but I'm putting this word out. If you want to share some comments, please do. I don't want to be unfair in any way. We had John DiLorenzo on the agenda today, not because he's gone to some famous ski trip on Thursday. That's not the case in this situation, but because some of our own committee members couldn't be here on Thursday, so I decided to let him make a quick 20-25 minute presentation. He asked me if he could do it. He threw the word groups at me. That meant he was going to do a presentation on groups. I will confess, I did not think through entirely what that meant at the time. This presentation is something that I hope anybody that wants to will have an opportunity to respond to at a later time. Again, my purpose is to be as fair as I can. The presentation is tonight because some of our committee members couldn't be here on Thursday. Okay, with that, John, I want to hear from you for a few minutes.
Thank you.
Why don't you come up with more black books?
Could you maybe color code them next time, like go to purple or red?
Yeah, we had your black book. What? The next one's got to be red.
What?
Whatever the committee's pleasure, Mr. Chairman.
We're just trying to get it. We're just trying to get them to be a little more colorful. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee. I appreciate you inviting me to testify here today. For the record, my name is John DiLorenzo. I'm a partner with the law firm of Davis Wright Tremaine, and I'm here on behalf of Oregonians for Sound Economic Policy. The purpose of my testimony is to inform you as to our discoveries relating to SAFE's relationships with various trade groups through the establishment of group programs and the political advantages which SAFE gains as a result. Many of you were members of the Senate Interim Committee on General Government, which devoted a significant amount of time addressing issues relating to SAFE and events which led up to Judge Lipscomb's finding of contempt. The first such judicial finding ever to be made against a state agency, as far as we know. On September 15, 2004, I was invited to testify before your interim committee to outline SAFE's relationship with Associated Oregon Industries and its relationship with Associated General Contractors. Specifically, I outlined our findings from the records produced by SAFE regarding SAFE's financing of the production of the Business Viewpoint magazine and its increase in financing of the magazine in exchange for elimination of the dividend bonus program that used to inure to the benefit of AOI. I also presented our findings relating to the manner in which SAFE funds found their way to Associated General Contractors, only to be expended on payment of legal fees to fight initiative petitions and the payment of trade association lobbyists to provide additional support for SAFE's legislative agenda. At the conclusion of that testimony, I made 9 recommendations. On September 20th, 2004, Ms. Rockland was invited to appear before the interim committee. During a portion of her testimony, she specifically addressed our recommendations. On February 15th of this year, SAFE released the first installment of its top-to-bottom review to the governor and addressed many of the issues outlined before the interim committee. I have taken the liberty to outline OSEP's recommendations that were made on September 15th, SAFE's responses on September 20th, and SAFE's actions up to and including today for each of those issues in the form of a chart, which I have appended at tab 2 of your materials. And so if you take a look at that chart, you will find 3 columns: our recommendations, SAFE's responses on September 20th, and SAFE's actions up to today. I have specifically highlighted recommendations 2, 1, 2, 8, and 9 because those are the ones that apply to SAFE's group plans. Those recommendations were provided to the interim committee in an effort to address what had been SAFE's practice of entering into lucrative agreements with a number of trade organizations, which in turn supplied support for SAFE's political agenda. Ms. Rockland's responses are summarized on the chart. In addition, a transcript of her remarks particular to OSEP's recommendations are also appended at tab 3 of your materials. Ms. Rockland generally agreed that state agencies should not pay public money to assist private groups in the dissemination of their political messages. She also generally agreed that government agencies should not expend public money for the purpose of impacting the initiative process or covertly lobbying the Legislative Assembly. She also generally agreed that SAFE should not give preferential treatment to particular associations in exchange for political support. Although she agreed with the general premises as stated in our recommendations, she denied that those particular things in general were happening at SAFE. With respect to SAFE's financing of the Business Viewpoint magazine, she indicated that SAFE would examine the arrangement as part of its top-to-bottom review and ultimately concluded that future funding of the publication Business Viewpoint should be eliminated. Notwithstanding SAFE's position that its group program arrangements with some trade groups are not designed to engender political support for SAFE's agenda, our investigation of SAFE's documents and other public records presents a very different picture. First, favored groups provide political support to SAFE. Recently, we were furnished with copies of all of SAFE's existing group contracts. These contracts were, incidentally, the types of documents which SAFE sought to designate as trade secrets under the public records law and which SAFE could continue to shield where SAFE's records policy once again reconnected to ORS Chapter 192, as Senate Bill 310 currently proposes. At tab 4, we have appended a chart. And if you fold the chart open, you will see that the chart shows the name of each group or broker, the members in the group, the total premiums produced by the group, and the various types of fees which SAFE Corporation pays to either the group directly or to the broker. The fees consist of those for core services, fees for a magazine, management fees, commissions, incentive bonuses, and other forms of compensation. Later in the chart, we provide a percentage of cash compensation to the trade organization as a percentage of its total premium, and then list cash compensation as a percentage of premium, discounting any commissions that are paid. Finally, on the chart, we have gleaned through our survey of the Secretary of State's contributions and expenditures reports the total contributions made by the particular group or broker to the Committee for Safekeeping, a political committee which opposed Ballot Measure 38, which would have abolished SAFE Corporation. Some have argued that the business community is uniformly supportive of SAFE as the best vehicle for maintaining low workers' compensation rates. Were that true, we would have expected all business trade organizations to have been financially supportive of the committee's efforts to beat back Ballot Measure 38. That, however, was not the case. A review of the chart makes clear that those trade organizations which received insubstantial cash rewards from SAFE made little, if any, contribution to the effort to beat back Measure 38. However, the trade organizations highlighted in green made substantial contributions. Those contributions are also summarized at tab 5. One of those organizations, Associated General Contractors, receives $1,388,000 per year from SAFE Corporation. OSEP has long since argued that since much of AGC's programmatic functions are financed by SAFE, SAFE can always count upon AGC to support its political agenda. This theory bears out when one notes that AGC contributed $1,094,708 to the campaign to defeat Measure 38, consisting of a $100,000 direct donation from the AGC Committee for Action, other contributions in the amount of $10,154, and loans to the committee in the amount of $1,084,554. Likewise, Associated Oregon Loggers Services, Inc., the servicing agent for Associated Oregon Loggers, receives $847,603 per year for loss prevention services and $727,476 per year in commissions in addition to other forms of compensation. Not surprisingly, Associated Oregon Logger Services, Inc., an organization which is supposed to derive substantially all of its revenues from SAFE Corporation, was able to find $491,331 in cash for the purpose of making a donation to the Committee for Safekeeping. Interestingly, Associated Oregon Services Corporation, Associated Oregon Industries Services Corporation, also an organization which supposedly derives most of its revenue from its contract with SAFE, found $11,331 to donate to the Committee for Safekeeping. We suspect that AOI also urged its members to make many individual contributions which were reflected on the committee's C&E reports. Somewhat troubling is a copy of a letter dated December 6, 2004 from Mr. Richard Buttrick of AOI to Brenda Rockland of SAFE Corporation. That letter appears at tab 6 of your materials. In the letter, Mr. Buttrick assures Ms. Rockland that membership dues at AOI will not be used for political purposes. It also states that AOI does not make any contributions to AOI's Center for Citizen Leadership, which in turn serves as the AOI PAC. Mr. Buttrick states the same is true for AOI Service Corporation. This letter was evidently written in response to OSEP's suggestion that money paid by SAFE to various trade organizations was in turn used for political purposes. What Mr. Buttrick does not tell Ms. Rockland in the letter is the fact that AOI Service Corporation, which derives its funding from SAFE, contributed $11,331 to the No on 38 campaign just a few months before the December 6, 2004 letter. Now, as we know, SAFE has agreed to eliminate future funding of AOI's Business Viewpoint magazine. Although this action by SAFE addresses criticisms which were leveled at the agency for utilizing public funds to finance dissemination of private political views, that action by SAFE has resulted in a budget hole at AOI. Our records requests reveal, however, that SAFE has once again found a way to more than replace the revenues which have been lost to AOI by reason of SAFE's elimination of the funding of Business Viewpoint. As early as 2003, AOI requested the opportunity to become a full insurance agency, appointed by SAFE to receive commissions as a result. The letter from AOI Service Corporation, dated July 15, 2003, appended at tab 7 of your materials, reflects that request. 2 days later, SAFE personnel analyzed AOI's request. At tab 8, you will find an email from Michael Hartman at SAFE to John Gilkey and Dave Thurber at SAFE regarding AOI's request to become an insurance agency. Mr. Hartman observes at the middle of the page that the home builders and Associated Oregon Loggers are industry-specific niche players. As specialists, they provide risk management services specifically designed for exposure to their client bases. AOI, on the other hand, is comprised of medium to large accounts in a variety of industries. In his recommendation, Mr. Hartman suggests that AOI not be appointed as an agent because the business value derived from SAFE from industry-specific agencies would not exist with a large group like AOI. In addition, it would open the door for identical requests from other associations. Based on additional reasons, Mr. Hartman suggests that AOI's agency request be denied. Several days later, at tab 9, Mr. Thurber responds to Mr. Buttrick that an AOI agency appointment is not compatible with SAFE's business practices concerning agency appointments. Almost a year later, Mr. Thurber writes another letter to Mr. Buttrick. That letter, dated May 10, 2004, appears at tab 10 of your materials. On the second page of that letter, Mr. Thurber once again states, quote, "For the many reasons stated a year ago now, we are not extending an agency appointment to AOI." Well, of course, that position was taken by SAFE prior to the time the public became aware that SAFE Corporation was financing the publication of AOI's Business Viewpoint magazine to the tune of approximately $400,000 plus per year. All of a sudden, the atmosphere appeared to change. SAFE found its support of AOI's magazine to be controversial at best. Around that same time, SAFE completely reversed its prior policy and granted AOI a limited agency agreement. A copy of that limited agency agreement, effective September 1, 2004, is appended at tab 11 of your materials. The agreement provides for commissions for AOI Service Corporation at 2.5% of standard premium, up to $100,000, and in a negotiated amount for premiums over $100,000. The limited agency agreement appears to apply to new business placed by AOI on or after September 1, 2004. Tab 12 of your materials reflects a fairly mysterious email that appears to have been edited, identifying the recipient as Brenda Rockman, but not clearly identifying the sender. The date of the email is also missing, as is the email string that preceded it. It is evidently an explanation provided to Ms. Rockman as to why AOI has been granted a limited agency appointment. The email states that the AOI limited agency appointment discussion began with AOI in June of 2004. This was shortly after the newspapers reported that SAFE was paying for the publication of AOI's magazine. On November 10, 2004, Ms. Rockman addressed a letter to Mr. Buttrick, a copy of which is appended at tab 13. In that letter, she requests AOI's actual costs and budgets for risk management and publication of the Business Viewpoint magazine. She states, quote, "My expectation is that this review will provide me with the necessary confidence I need to publicly respond to the substance and integrity of our contract with AOI. I see this work as part of my top-to-bottom review of SAFE, and specifically on issues that have been the focus of public criticism by legislators and others," unquote. Although Ms. Rockman appears to request various budgets from AOI, no documentation was apparently provided in response to this letter. On December 6, 2004, AOI realized that support of the Business Viewpoint magazine would come to an end.
At tab 14, Mr. Buttrick observed that the AOI Service Corporation had been appointed as an insurance agency by Safe Corporation. At the second page, he proposed that AOI's new agency receive 3% of the total premium for AOI members. This document, obtained from SAFE, has a number of handwritten notations supplied by an unidentified SAFE official. Although many of the handwritten notations are somewhat telling, the most telling is a notation suggesting that Mr. Buttrick's proposal will generate $1.3 million annually for AOI versus the $610,000 lost by virtue of elimination of SAFE support of Business Viewpoint magazine and possibly including the other elements of their risk management compensation. On December 21, Mr. Michael Hartman analyzed AOI's group statistics. That analysis is attached at tab 15 of your materials. Mr. Hartman indicates that he has utilized earned premium, which is more reflective of the real money SAFE keeps after all discounts. He concludes, quote, SAFE has lost money on grouping AOI members in the last six completed plan years. SAFE documents appended at tab 16 echo this concern. That tab, entitled Risk Management Service, that tab is entitled AOI Risk Management Services Return on Investment. The document notes that since calendar year 1993, SAFE's return on its investment in AOI's risk management has been a negative 2.7%. At tab 17, SAFE Corporation addresses a letter dated January 3, 2005 to AOI. Mr. Michael Hartman states, quote, once we have an agreement on the nature of the work as outlined here, we will need to develop the cost to deliver the services. SAFE has provided you some information already with regard to our own costs for these types of services and training, and you have provided me with projected costs for your publication charges. We should be able to arrive at an agreed upon amount that SAFE will pay for these various, for these specific services within a short time, unquote. The passage strongly suggests that SAFE was looking for a way to replace the revenue, which would be lost to AOI due to the decision to eliminate SAFE support of AOI's magazine. At tab 18, Mr. Michael Hartman at SAFE Corporation sends Mr. Steve Cotton at SAFE a new draft of the SAFE AOI Professional Services Agreement. Mr. Hartman entitles the document XOXOXOXOXO. The subject of the email, which forwards the draft, is also entitled XOXOXOXOXO, suggesting a hugs and kisses contract with AOI. At tab 19, Ms. Rockland sends to Mr. Buttrick on January 14, 2005, that contract draft referenced in the prior email, along with a check for $393,509 as a final payment for AOI's Business Viewpoint magazine. She states that the draft contract is SAFE's response to the ideas set forth in Mr. Buttrick's December 6 letter and their subsequent meeting. Finally, at tab 20, Mr. Thurber briefs the Board of Directors on January 17, 2005 regarding the new proposed AOI contract. Mr. Thurber states that the contract is in response to criticism of SAFE for support of AOI's magazine. In the memo, he admits that the new contract is in response to the Board's directive to eliminate the financial support of Business Viewpoint magazine as soon as is practical. However, the memo does not inform the board that AOI's group contract has not been profitable to SAFE. The memo does not inform the board that SAFE's investment in AOI's risk management services in the past has produced a negative return on investment. The board is not informed that AOI's existing risk management services are costing SAFE Corporation an average of $225 per hour. Finally, no mention is made that the new proposed contract will potentially provide AOI more revenue than it will have ever lost by virtue of elimination of the support for the magazine. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, something is very wrong here. SAFE's decision to provide AOI Service Corporation commissions and a limited agency appointment is a total about-face and disregards every policy consideration raised only a year before by SAFE management. What circumstances have changed? The only circumstances which have changed, in our opinion,
is the exposure of AOI's sweetheart deal with Safe Corporation for the publication of its magazine a sweetheart deal replaced by yet another sweetheart deal. Now, Associated General Contractors' contract was also reviewed and renewed in September of 2004. A copy of that contract is appended at tab 21. That contract pays AGC $1,388,000 per year. Despite SAFE's agreement with AGC to take steps to assure the legislature that SAFE's funds will no longer be utilized to oppose ballot measures or lobby the legislature, no specific prohibition was included by SAFE in the last negotiated contract. In addition, as tab 22 discloses, SAFE originally proposed that it would conduct an annual audit to measure the association's compliance with the agreement. As the tab further discloses, SAFE changed during the course of negotiation the word will to may, thereby effectively eliminating the annual audit requirement. Well, our review of the documents recently supplied by SAFE lead us to the following conclusions. First, SAFE's group's contracts discriminate among groups. Some groups are treated extremely favorably. Other groups receive little, if any, monetary compensation from SAFE. Number two, whether by design or de facto, trade organizations which receive the most direct compensation from SAFE provide the greatest political support to SAFE. In many instances, the trade organizations devote funds initially derived from SAFE to maintain SAFE's political position. Number three, SAFE has taken no effective action to eliminate past abuses in this area, notwithstanding its agreement in principle to put an end to those practices. Number four, although SAFE has put an end to its financial support of AOI's Business Viewpoint magazine, it has made a decision to reverse a well-articulated prior policy and appoint AOI as a limited agent, thereby entitling AOI to commission compensation, a new revenue stream. It is unclear at present as to whether the SAFE AOI contract has been fully renegotiated. Well, we have some recommendations. First, because SAFE is not willing to recommend legislation or changes to its contract language designed to eliminate many of the abuses previously identified, we believe this committee should consider utilizing either Senate Bill 310, which relates to the management of the State Accident Insurance Fund Corporation, or Senate Bill 986, which relates to the State Accident Insurance Fund Corporation, as follows. First, the committee should consider incorporating the first sentence of Section 1 of Senate Bill 986, requiring that SAFE establish written criteria for participation in any rating group or dividend group plan. SAFE should also be required to contract with any group that meets that criteria. The disparities reflected in the chart at tab 4 are clear indications of favoritism and should not be tolerated from a state agency which is expected to treat all groups and all persons equally. Number two, given SAFE's unwillingness to insist on mandatory audits of its group plans, the committee should incorporate Section 2 of Senate Bill 986, requiring the Division of Audits to audit those agreements periodically. Three, given SAFE's propensity to permit AOI and other groups to be compensated for risk management services, one of the bills should be amended to require SAFE to request proposals and or to put out for bid such services and award such contracts only to the lowest qualified bidder. And fourth, one of the bills should be amended to require that SAFE funds received by any corporation or entity with an organization maintaining a group plan with SAFE may not be expended for political purposes and may not be used to reimburse any entity that engages in political activity. Mr. Chairman, I thank you and the committee for your patience and interest, and I am available to answer any questions you may have about our presentation and our materials.
I'm not going to entertain any questions this afternoon. We're going to have time for questions. I'm sure you'll be back here. Others will be back here. People will be responding to this afternoon's presentation, I'm sure. I want to give people that opportunity. I will continue to be as fair as I can. Two members of the committee were not here for part part or all of your presentation. I want them to have a chance to read your written testimony and to look through the book. I will allow us to make a comment about additional information we might want. I don't want questions right now, but if you have questions about additional information that we might want, either from Mr. DiLorenzo or from SAFE, for example, if either Senator Walker or Senator George have questions of that nature, just very briefly. I want to end this hearing in about 2 minutes. But Senator Walker?
Yes, Mr. Chair. It's become painfully obvious to me from this presentation that there is one person I would like to bring into the committee to talk with us. And that person is no longer employed at SAFE, but I think that person has a lot to talk about. That would be Mr. David Thurber. I believe, as far as I know, Mr. Thurber still resides in Salem. I would ask that the chair make that invitation to Mr. Thurber to come to our committee, and if he doesn't want to come willingly, because he may be under some agreement from being terminated, we can extend a subpoena to Mr. Thurber, but I would think that he would be able to come. But, Mr. Chair, this contract and this memo dated January 17, 2005, really, really raises the hair on the back of my neck. And okay. I've got a lot of questions for Mr. Thurber. This is this year, Mr. Chair.
I understand that. And we've been having hearings throughout the interim, which I chaired. I'll take that request under consideration. Senator George, you have any requests for information? Okay. With that... Yes.
I just would like to make the request. As you know, Mr. Chair, I will not be here in the state on Thursday, so that if Mr. Thurber does come, I would ask that we make that next week.
Right. Okay. With that, I'm going to adjourn the hearing. I will see several of you on Thursday.